joining the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Hope you're having a great weekend. It's been a long time since we released a podcast over a weekend. Probably not since we had a radio program. So this is the first in a long time that we've done that. But I had a couple things I wanted to talk about, or mainly one thing I wanted to talk about for today's brief podcast. I wanted to highlight Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She is a Democratic congresswoman from Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. She has been very controversial and been in the news as the squad has been highlighted. But there's a couple things that she has done that I wanted to, you know, our listeners to be aware of. In a lot of ways, I think she's probably even worse than Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But before we get to any of that, first a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
And we're back. Well, Democratic Representative Omar of Minnesota has a history of making anti-Semitic remarks. She criticized AIPAC and said that Republican support for Israel is, quote, all about the Benjamins, unquote, in a tweet last February, which is a common anti-Semitic trope. Now she has introduced a pro-BDS resolution. So Omar's resolution revealed on Wednesday, co-sponsored by Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, as well as Representative John Lewis, a Democrat from Georgia, seeks to oppose unconstitutional legislative efforts to limit the use of boycotts to further civil rights at home and abroad, and urges Congress, states, and civil rights leaders from all communities to endeavor to preserve the freedom of advocacy for all by opposing anti-boycott resolutions and legislation. So I want to play you a clip during the House Foreign Affairs Committee markup. Congresswoman Omar defended the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is basically trying to defund Israel and punishing them for their occupation of the Gaza Strip and West Bank and just how they treat, because of, you know, the tensions they have with the Palestinians. Obviously, very one-sided, obviously blames Israel for everything that's going on. But anyway, in this clip, she actually compares the BDS movement to other boycott movements leading back to the Boston Tea Party, she says. So take a listen. This was on Wednesday that she said this.
But as in all diplomacy, truly pursuing peace isn't just about punishing bad behavior. We must support efforts to end the occupation and achieve two-state solution. I believe firmly that the path to peace does not lie in a violent means. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We should condemn in the strongest terms violence that perpetuates the occupation, whether it is perpetuated by Israel, Hamas, or individuals. But if we are going to condemn violent means of resisting the occupation, we cannot also condemn nonviolent means. We cannot simultaneously say we want peace, then openly oppose peaceful means to hold our allies accountable. It is precisely when people feel hopeful, when people feel that nonviolence does not work, that their voices won't be heard, that they turn towards violence. This week, I introduced a resolution with civil rights leader, our colleague John Lewis, and Rashida Tlaib, who know the importance of nonviolence movements. It recognizes the proud history of boycott movements in this country dating back to the Boston Tea Party. We should honor these movements and that history, and we should honor our commitment to the principles that say we must hold our friends to the same standards.
Not all Democrats are on board with this. California Democratic U.S. Representative Brad Sherman, one of the more senior Jewish lawmakers in the House, told the Jerusalem Post that the resolution proposed by his fellow Democrat is not serious. Quote, I can't imagine that any committee is going to mark up and take seriously any pro-BDS resolution, Sherman said. He asked, am I worried about the overall BDS movement worldwide as an economic matter? No. As an effort to delegitimize Israel? Of course. And he said the comments here today on Wednesday are a tiny part of that effort. So then U.S. Representative Elliot Engel of New York told the Washington Times, he's another Democrat, quote, I think the BDS movement is harmful and anyone that promotes it is making a big mistake. Engel is facing a primary challenge from the Justice Democrats, of which Omar is a part. Then pro-Israel Democrats proposed an anti-BDS resolution that passed the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Wednesday. Fox News reports, accusing the boycott movement against the Jewish state of promoting, quote, principles of collective guilt, mass punishment, and group isolation, unquote. U.S. Representative Ted Deutsch, I think that I'm pronouncing that correct, out of Florida, he's another Democrat, said during the committee hearing that the BDS movement, quote, envisions a world without Israel, unquote, before adding, quote, I reject it, unquote. So during the hearing immediately after Omar gave her spiel about the BDS resolution and defending it, U.S. Representative Lee Zeldin of New York, a Republican, hit back at Omar after her defense. He focused on her use of the words honest and honesty during her comments defending the bill. Let's take a listen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate you bringing this en bloc up today. I fully support this, and it's important for me to point out a few things as my colleague who just spoke used the frequent use of the words honestly and honest, let's just get to a lot of what's left out. So the BDS movement has not distanced itself from Hamas, a designated foreign terrorist organization. BDS supporters individually are not distancing themselves from Hamas either. It is wrong to be blaming all Israeli and Palestinian violence, quote, as being due to an occupation.
I'm waiting.
Last Friday, Fathi Hamad, a senior Hamas official, called upon Palestinians worldwide to kill all Jews. This is a senior Hamas official just before the weekend. During a closed meeting in October 2017 between Hamas chief Sinwar and Gazan youth about reconciling with the Fatah movement, Sinwar stated that the time spent discussing recognition of Israel is over, and now Hamas will instead discuss when they will wipe Israel out. Hamas uses women and children as human shields. They declare jihad as an obligation. They deny humanitarian aid to their own people. They deny human rights. Launching rockets from Gaza into Israel, killing innocent civilians. Tens of thousands of rockets in Lebanon ready to be launched by Hezbollah. Existential threats to Israel all around it. Our greatest ally in the Middle East. One that there's been a historic relationship between our two nations. A beacon of hope and freedom and liberty in a region of the world that is filled with challenges. We want to be neutral arbiters. Let's not deny our right and our duty to also be honest brokers. To spend an entire time in justifying opposition to HRES 246 based off of everything that's wrong is all due to the Israeli occupation. Why not point out the fact that in 2008, Israel offered to withdraw from 93% of Judea and Samaria in the West Bank? Or what about our students on college campuses right now from coast to coast being targeted with blatant anti-Semitism in the name of BDS? Or taking into consideration the founder of BDS and all of his blatant anti-Semitism. Or the Palestinian authorities pay to slay. They financially reward terrorism. They treat you to a state funeral. They will rename football stadiums after you. We want to use honesty in our remarks. We'll give you a whole lot more honesty. Every year, Hamas mobilizes Palestinians in their days of rage to attack Israelis at their border, calling them to throw rocks and fire missiles at Israel. Often results in actual violence. Hamas uses incendiary kites and balloons, which has destroyed some 8,000 acres of Israeli farms, parks, and forests. And I was pointing out, just last Friday, a senior Hamas official called for the murder of every Jew in the world. And you want to oppose HRES 246 under the justification that all the violence is due to an Israeli occupation with no honesty as it relates to any of the violence targeting innocent Americans.
Jake Tapper of ABC News had an interesting Twitter thread. Several Democrats approached him on Wednesday anonymously to kind of speak their mind. One House Democrat told ABC, told Tapper that he or she, we don't exactly know who it was disappointed by the selective outrage shown by the House Democratic Caucus. Quote, "Everybody was completely outraged by what the president said," unquote, said House Dem number 3. Quote, "And everybody thought it was appropriate to criticize him, but this was the first time the House has taken action to criticize him in any way. We couldn't even bring ourselves to have a resolution exclusively condemning anti-Semitism uttered by one of those members," unquote. Obviously talking about Omar, but quote, "But we leapt to their defense here," unquote, he tweeted on Wednesday. Tapper did. Then the two House Democrats noted their BDS resolution. Quote, "A few House Dems noted that Omar and Tlaib just introduced a resolution affirming the right of Americans to boycott, perceived as an expression of support for the anti-Israel BDS," that's again boycott, divest, and sanction movement, "that most House Dems oppose," Tapper tweeted. Quote, "So we'll hear a tirade of attacks on Israel from the same group," unquote, said House Democrat number 3, who had the earlier quote. And quote, "Hopefully they won't be anti-Semitic," unquote. I wouldn't hold your breath on that. House Democrat number 4 that he quoted also brought up that bill, coming from, quote, "from someone with a history of anti-Semitism," again, Omar is talking about, unquote. So, quote, "So yeah, it's challenging," unquote. Ilhan Omar has, unfortunately, no regrets about her anti-Semitic remarks. During a CBS interview with four of the most outspoken freshmen, the Democrats in Congress, a.k.a. the Squad, that would be Congresswoman Presley, Ocasio-Cortez, Tlaib, and, of course, Omar, Omar said she has no regrets about the anti-Semitic comments she has made in the past. Let's take a listen.
"Oftentimes there are things that you might say might not hold weight for you, but to someone else, right? The way that we hear and consume information is very different than how the next person might."
"So you don't regret your words either?"
"I do not, but I have gotten I am grateful for the opportunity to really learn how my words made people feel, and have taken every single opportunity I've gotten to make sure that people understood that I apologize for it."
Omar had a fiery exchange with Elliot Abrams, the special envoy to Venezuela, who incidentally is also a Jew, back in February in the House Foreign Relations Committee. Abrams in 1991 pled guilty to 2 counts of withholding information from Congress related to the Iran-Contra affair and was pardoned by President George W. Bush in 1991. This was 28 years ago. Omar at that time was probably 9 or 10. She was born, I believe, in 1981, younger than me. She blasted him over it as if nothing he had to say about human rights abuses in Venezuela were relevant. If you missed that exchange, here it is.
Thank you, Ms. Omar.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your testimonies. Mr. Adams, in 1991, you pleaded guilty to 2 counts of withholding information from Congress regarding your involvement in the Iran-Contra affair, for which you were later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush. I fail to understand why members of this committee or the American people should find any testimony that you give.
If I can respond to that.
It wasn't a question.
That was not a question.
I reserve the right to my time.
It is not right.
That was not a question.
Members of this committee can attack
on February 8th,
who is not permitted to reply.
That was not a question. Thank you for your participation. On February 8th, 1982, you testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about U.S. policy in El Salvador. In that hearing, you dismissed as communist propaganda report about the massacre of El Mozote, in which more than 800 civilians, including children as young as 2 years old, were brutally murdered by U.S.-trained troops. During that massacre, some of those troops bragged about raping a 12-year-old girl before they killed them. You later said that the U.S. policy in El Salvador was a fabulous achievement. Yes or no, do you still think so?
From the day that President Duarte was elected in a free election to this day, El Salvador has been a democracy. That's a fabulous achievement.
Yes or no, do you think that massacre was a fabulous achievement that happened under our watch?
That is a ridiculous question, and I
yes or no?
No.
I will take that as a yes.
I am not going to respond to that kind of personal attack, which is not a question.
Yes or no, would you support an armed faction within Venezuela that engages in war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide, if you believe they were serving U.S. interest, as you did in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua?
I am not going to respond to that question. I'm sorry. I don't think this entire line of questioning is meant to be real questions, and so I will not reply.
Whether you, under your watch, a genocide will take place, and you will look the other way because American interests were being upheld, is a fair question, because the American people want to know that anytime we engage, think about what our actions could be and how we believe our values are being furthered. That is my question. Will you make sure that human rights are not violated and that we uphold international and human rights?
I suppose there is a question in there, and the answer is that the entire thrust of American policy in Venezuela is to support the Venezuelan people's effort to restore democracy to their country. That's our policy.
I don't think anybody disputes that. The question I had for you is that does the interest of the United States include protecting human rights and include protecting people against genocide?
That is always the position of the United States.
Thank you. I yield back my time.
She practically accused the guy of supporting genocide, which is remarkable. Even if the anti-communist regime in El Salvador did commit those atrocities. And honestly, I don't remember the history behind that. I haven't had a chance to look it up. I know no sides down in El Salvador were necessarily, they didn't necessarily keep their hands clean or didn't get their hands dirty at all. But that also, I think, she glosses over the human rights abuses that you saw from the communists, the Sandinistas, during that time as well. So it was a lot more complicated than I think what she is expressing. But yeah, the policy of the United States, yeah, even under Ronald Reagan, was not to support genocide. So this outrage she had, what she talks about at Netroots Nation, is remarkable since, again, she was a child when this happened, and I believe she didn't immigrate she didn't come to the United States until she was like 8, I believe. So she would have, you know, this would have been, she'd only been in the United States like 2 years when this happened. So I really find this remarkable, that she was this upset when she doesn't necessarily have historical context for it. So anyway, here's a clip from her defending her remarks during Netroots Nation. Not only that, but also some of her anti-Semitic remarks as well.
What they're doing with our foreign policy in regards to Venezuela, Iran, Yemen, all of these policies, we often don't get to have a clear debate about the people he's appointing to lead in these areas as an envoy, which is why I lost my mind when Elliot Abrams came to my committee.
Okay, let's just
right,
stop.
Like,
yeah.
It is just...
I want to pause there because that was the moment when you spoke out against outside influence on the committee, the role of AIPAC and all that, that the attacks on you, the threats on you, not only from people in the administration, but from writ large, the white supremacists out there. Since you spoke out about something that was supposedly the third rail, the way that I'd interpret it from the outside was that you were being punished not only from the other party, but even we heard from people in the Democratic Party for calling attention to that. That happened. It was an outcry. Where does that stand now in terms of making the space to be able to, as an elected representative, call out this kind of thing?
Well, I create my space. Listen, here is the hard truth. The hard truth is that no one who has my experience collectively in all of the marginalized identities that I carry has ever set foot on the halls of Congress. On the Foreign Affairs Committee, every single thing that's debated, whether it is the kind of aid we're going to send, whether it is, you know, how we're going to support refugees, whether it is proxy wars in Africa, whether it is the division of the African continent, all of these policies that have sort of impacted my life in the most detrimental ways that have brought me to the United States, all of these were debated in that committee. And every single person who looks like me, who has had my lived experience at some point or another, has watched that committee and screamed at that TV and said, ask this question. And so you know when I get the opportunity to sit there and look at this man in the face, knowing the kind of history he's had and how he's lied and was convicted because he lied to Congress, and the trail of blood that he has left in South and Central America, that I wasn't going to let him get away and come in to talk to us about what he was going to do in Venezuela. Knowing his history, I was going to ask the questions that every single person sitting in front of that TV wanted to ask, because now they get to be in that room and they get to shout in their face.
Then to cap it off, there's the potential immigration fraud and tax fraud that the national media tends to gloss over. The Minneapolis St. Paul Star Tribune ran a report in late June that has largely been ignored by the national mainstream press. They write, quote, "New investigative documents released by a state agency have given fresh life to lingering questions about the marital history of Representative Ilhan Omar and whether she once married a man, possibly her own brother, to skirt immigration laws. Omar has denied the allegations in the past, dismissing them as, quote, baseless rumors, unquote, first raised in an online Somali politics forum and championed by conservative bloggers during her 2016 campaign for the Minnesota House. But she said little then or since about Ahmed Nur Said Elmi, and probably Elmi, excuse me, the former husband who swept into her life in 2009 before a 2011 separation. The question surfaced again this month in a state probe of campaign finance violations, showing that Omar filed federal taxes in 2014 and 2015 with her current husband, Ahmed Hershey, while she was still legally married to but separated from Elmi. Although she had legally corrected the discrepancy, she had declined to say anything about how or why it happened. Then later on in the article, we read, it says, quote, "Omar declined to make her tax and immigration records available for this report," unquote. And then further down, we read, quote, "They sent a list of questions and a request to talk to her siblings and father. Omar declined to do so. Hershey did not reply to multiple calls, texts, and emails. Social media posts indicate Elmi is in Africa. He did not respond to multiple emails," unquote. Then further down, quote, "Omar and Elmi used a Columbia Heights address on the marriage application. 3 months later, Hershey used the same address to obtain a business license for his one-on-one cafe lounge," public records show. "Omar declined to offer an account of their living arrangement at that time," unquote. Then a little bit later, it says, quote, "Omar's relatives could also clear the air, but they have remained silent about her marriage to Elmi. She declined to make her family available for this story. In 2016, her campaign provided the names of six siblings, but only their first names, citing the need for privacy. Elmi was not among them." Then later on, quote, "In October 2018, Omar showed a Star Tribune reporter cell phone photos of family immigration papers, but would not share the actual documents," unquote. So, yeah, this is, first of all, the national media is trying to make it sound as though this is just some right-wing conspiracy. And I want to highlight again, this is a report I just read from in the Minneapolis St. Paul Star Tribune. This is the same newspaper in 2016 that endorsed Hillary Clinton. So remember that. Also, the rumors about her, a potential marriage to her brother, that didn't start in the conservative blogosphere. That started in a Somali political forum, not a conservative outlet. So because these things were noticed, because certain social media posts that now in the Minneapolis or the Star Tribune article points out has been taken down, you know, there's these questions have been raised. Now, I don't think we're ever going to be able to prove beyond a shadow of doubt that, you know, she married her brother. I think I'd say that aspect of the rumor mill or with this whole thing with the Star Tribune report is probably won't gain any traction because you can't really prove it because Somali records are hard to come by and they're not always accurate. She's not being forthright. They haven't been able to get a hold of this guy. She's never identified him as a brother. They're never going to be able to probably get, especially if he's out of country, because I believe they said he was in Africa, but I believe he's also living in London. You're not going to be able to get DNA, you know, get a hold of DNA records or anything like that. So I think this is probably a non-starter. But what is remarkable to me is, and this is why it has legs, and maybe it should have legs, is that you know, she's being so secretive and so unwilling to, you know, obviously she said, I can't prove a negative. Well, I think it's pretty easy to debunk the fact if your first husband is not your brother, that should be easy to debunk, I would believe. So I don't understand, you know, why not even let her family talk about, you know, talk to reporters about it. I think for transparency's sake, if she would like to nip this in the bud, she could go ahead and do that. The fact that she's not released immigration and tax documents, I think, is telling as well. I think we do need an explanation as to why she filed federal taxes in 2015 with her current husband, who she actually wasn't married to at the time, while she was still legally married to somebody else. You know, that's a problem. That's tax fraud. I mean, yeah, she corrected it, but she's never provided an explanation to it for it. I know she points out there's with Islam, there's a distinction between cultural and legal marriage. But however, in the United States, we don't make that distinction. So she needs to explain herself. She's a member of Congress. She's been in the United States since she was 8. She can't feign ignorance because she's in her 30s. I believe she's 37 years old. She should know about this stuff by now. My goodness, if she's going to be Congress, going to be voting on tax bills, she should be able to understand how to put together her taxes. So these are questions that need to be answered. She needs an explanation. And, you know, this shouldn't go away. Unfortunately, I'm afraid the mainstream media is going to kind of try their best to bury it. So I find it fascinating that the Star Tribune published a report on this. I hope they continue to follow up on this as more information, you know, as they discover more information. I hope they just don't let it go. And kudos to them for following up on this. Oftentimes when news gets generated in the conservative blogosphere, and like I said, originally didn't originate in the conservative blogosphere, there's a tendency for mainstream media to overlook it or dismiss it or not pay attention to it. So I want to commend them for actually following through on it and investigating it. So good for them. That's how journalism is supposed to work. So congratulations to them. I hope they keep it up. Well, that's all I've got to say about Omar today. She is a congresswoman that we need to keep our eye on. We need to be vigilant about. You know, she was this highlighted this week mainly because President Trump's suggestion via Twitter that if they didn't like it in the United States, they should go back to where they came from and work to, you know, basically, I don't remember the exact tweet, but basically then come back and share what they learned, etc. And then in North Carolina, you had a chant that said, send them home, send them home. Well, she's a citizen. Unless, obviously, she committed immigration fraud, but that's a whole different can of worms, and I don't think that's ever going to get proven. But she's a citizen. She's not going to go home. Instead of chanting, you know, send her home, I think we should be chanting vote her out, because that's what I think Minnesota's voters need to do. That particular congressional district is not friendly to Republicans. I think the best shot that Minnesotans have to get her ousted would be through a Democratic primary. The Somali community is growing in that particular district, so that in itself would also probably be a challenge. But anyway, I want to wrap it up. I want to thank you for listening. That concludes today's podcast. If you're listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinated, caffeinated, thoughts.com, or just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Also, subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts. You know, if you're on Apple Podcasts, please, if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. We're also on Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify. I'm probably missing somebody else. Podbean. So if there's an app we're not on, you know, let me know, Shane at ShaneVanderhart.com or Shane at CaffeinatedThoughts.com, and I'll work to see if I can make that happen. So thank you so much for listening. Have a great rest of the weekend. This is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.